Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's July 15th, 2006. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. We're coming to you today in the midst of truly perilous developments. There's been a dramatic escalation in the last days of military combat, including in Southwest Asia or the Middle East, with the Israeli assault on Lebanon and the threats against Iran and Syria, and also following the devastating bombings which hit India in this last week, and the instability in the overall financial markets, with gold soaring about 6-7% last week, oil nearing the $80 a barrel mark, and the Japanese ending their 0% interest rate policy at the Bank of Japan meeting on Friday. Now, these events, especially the war in the Middle East and the bombings in India, are part of a coordinated offensive, not launched by any nation, but by forces run by international synarchy. And we'll be discussing what that means on the show today. Lyndon LaRouche has put out a new paper, which is timed to coincide with the G8 summit, which is opening today in St. Petersburg. And what he says in this is that the timing of these events, the war in the Mideast, the bombings in India, is to counter moves which may still come out of the G8 summit to proceed in the direction of a new financial system. The broader goal of what the synarchists are doing is to eliminate the one system which would threaten their global control. The synarchists are bent on establishing a global fascist order, which is based on eliminating the nation state, and in particular to wipe out forever the potential to do what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in the 1930s and 40s, to fight fascism the last time and to establish a monetary system on the basis of the principles of sovereign nation states. As I mentioned, Lyndon LaRouche is finishing a paper on this. We'll let you know during the course of the show how you can get a copy of this for circulation. And this memo is designed to inform the participants at the ongoing G8 summit on how to reassert the principle of the sovereign nation state and to move the world out of the danger represented by these synarchist forces and their henchmen such as Dick Cheney. This was the topic, in a sense, of last month's special EIR seminar in Berlin, which was opened by the following prophetic words by Lyndon LaRouche in his speech. He said, "In this period of time, we're in a world crisis without parallel. There's no comparison to this in European history since the 14th century New Dark Age to what we are facing now." And I say prophetic because if you look at the potential for the explosion of these events into a regional or global war, it's urgent that we look into the background of this crisis and find out who's behind it and how they would benefit from it. I'm delighted to welcome to the LaRouche Show for his first visit today, Dr. Clifford A. Kirikoff, Jr., who will be discussing this with us. Cliff, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Glad to be with you, Harley.
Dr. Kirikoff has worked in government, serving on staffs in the Senate for 11 years, the last six as a senior professional staff member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. He is presently a professor of American history and political science and is currently working on several books. Dr. Kirikoff has also attended the last five special EIR seminars in Berlin, Germany, and has delivered papers on matters of strategic importance, especially as it concerns the relationship of the United States historically to the dangers faced from these synarchist forces. His speech on June 27th was titled "The USA, Fascism Past and Present," and it's included in the latest EIR white paper, which is circulating nationally. We'll also be joined on the show today by two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, Jason Ross, who's here with me in Los Angeles, and Brian McAndrew, who's in Washington, D.C. Now, Cliff, just to get to the nub of things, I imagine that with the events of the last couple of days, with the danger implicit of regional, even global warfare, it brings to mind, to real life, the discussion that took place at the Berlin conference. What are your thoughts about this escalation in tensions and where we're headed?
Well, it's a very dangerous escalation of tensions, as you indicate. And at Berlin, the themes included the nature of the international system that's emerging, as you pointed out, one that should be composed of sovereign nation states cooperating together. And the conference also spoke to the issue of the international financial system and dangers in that system with respect to monetary issues, the dollar, problems with the American economy, the so-called twin deficits, our budget deficit, and then on the other hand, our international balance of payments or our capital account deficits. And so the conclusion, I think, or the consensus at the conference was that we're in a very fragile state with respect to the international financial system, and with respect to the state system, we hope that we can emerge in a multipolar world of sovereign states, but these new developments over the past several days cast more than a shadow on a happy outcome here.
Well, give me a sense, just from your perspective as an American who's been involved in shaping foreign policy with your work in the Senate and then now as a professor, these kinds of seminars, how valuable are they for providing a perspective on these crises?
Well, I can assure you that the Berlin seminars are extremely valuable. They're valuable not only to the individual participants, but they're also it also creates kind of a synergy among participants. Listeners may not know, but we've had senior people from Russia, from China, from India, from various European countries such as Germany and France, so that the level of discussion in a number of Middle Eastern countries, significant Middle Eastern countries, so the level of discussion and exchange of views has been very high. And I think over the past five such conferences, participants who attend more or less regularly are more and more coming to share certain perspectives and to agree that certainly we need to work on the international financial structure before it all tumbles down around us. And also we need to work toward a system of states in the world, sovereign nation states, on a Westphalian, what we call a Westphalian basis. That is to say, states have legal sovereignty, and they work together under international law, the rules, you could say, of the game. And that would be a positive world order, as we would call it. But, as you pointed out, there are forces on this planet who, for decades, if not centuries, have sought to overturn any Westphalia-like peaceful interaction or rules of the game with respect to sovereign nation states and try to impose a different type of world on us. And I think that's what we're confronted with today with the events in the Middle East. The issue for the G8 was going to be cooperation, how to cooperate among these eight major powers and cooperate in two ways, cooperate toward a better international system of states. And also Russia, the host, Mr. Putin, the host, had also had high on the agenda the idea of cooperation in what we call energy security. That is to say that all states need to be comfortable and have access to the energy resources they need so that they can develop properly.
And ironically, our vice president has been in the foreground on attacking Russia, accusing them of the opposite, of using their energy resources for blackmail.
Precisely. The issue of what is called energy security is more and more important. Actually, you could say every day of the week. Now, I haven't filled my gas tank today, but I can assure you when I go to the gas station tomorrow, I bet you I'll pay a little bit more for my gasoline than I did, say, 3 days ago. The issue of energy security is an issue that confronts all countries in the world, and it has implications for all countries because the price of energy obviously affects economic activity. Now, growing countries that are large, such as China and India, are requiring, obviously, more energy resources. There's over a billion people in each of those two countries. They're obviously requiring more energy resources as they industrialize and develop a more robust industrial economic activity. Now, That means that the international energy situation would see an increased demand, supply and demand, an increased demand occasioned by rising development of these countries and other factors, so that in order to avoid confrontation over energy resources, Mr. Putin had announced that energy security would be a theme of the G8 meeting, and the idea would be how to avoid confrontation over access to energy.
Mm-hmm.
And now, move toward cooperation, as Lyndon LaRouche has called for.
Right. Now, as you know, Cliff, on the LaRouche show, we actually talk about the names of the people involved, and one of the refreshing aspects of your speech, especially this most recent one, was the historical evaluations you presented of the danger not just of fascism at present, but that this has a history to it. I'd like to just take a couple minutes to go through a couple of the themes of your presentation. I want to remind listeners that this is the LaRouche Show. We're live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and we are taking email questions for Dr. Kirikoff and our panel. You can send an email to us at radio@larouchepub.com, radio@larouchepub.com, and we'll be happy to answer them. And if we don't get to all of them, we can get an answer out to you after the show. Now, in your presentation, you went through, why don't we just start with the, you identified what you mean by fascism. Now, most people in the United States have grown up under an education system which essentially says fascism and Hitler are synonymous. Why don't you just address that fallacy?
The definitional issues. Okay, let me approach that in two different ways. First, if we take a look at the 19th century, a century in which in Europe, there were two main contending currents: a progressive current that hoped for parliamentary government, constitutional government, the erection of republics in Europe, the unification of Germany and Italy, and a different type of what the Europeans call liberal, what we would call progressive form of government, a constitutional government. But at the same time, there were right-wing, monarchical, you could say, regimes that felt threatened by this, what the Europeans call liberal trend toward parliamentary government and constitutionalism. So a reaction against progressive thinkers and persons and ideas set in the 19th century in Europe, and police states were perfected in the 19th century based mostly on, say, the Napoleonic model, but a police state. Coming to the 20th century, a lot of that apparatus just shifted into the 20th century in the form of what we would in modern day times call fascism. The earliest example of that, of course, was with the Mussolini regime, D'Annunzio first, but the Mussolini regime in Italy. And so the fascisti, the Italian word there, for these type of people was used. A definition that I think is not a bad definition of fascism would include the rise of a demagogic leader sponsored by a plutocratic oligarchy. We could see also the curtailment of civil liberties. We would see the elimination of a free press. We would see the emasculation and crushing of labor and the labor movement, also small and medium-sized businesses. And we would also see the destruction of intellectual and political opposition.
And Dick Cheney might say, what's wrong with that?
Pardon?
Dick Cheney might say, what's wrong with that?
Well, precisely. what I was describing to you basically were the features of politics in Italy in the 1920s and 30s under Mr. Mussolini, or features of the politics in Germany under the Nazi or National Socialist regime, or in Spain, or in Romania, or in a number of countries in Europe that adopted what we would loosely call a fascist form of government. And that is of interest to us, because why did we fight World War II? Well, we fought World War II to stop that type of activity in the world and to try to get the world back toward a option for democratic constitutional governance inside states and a positive world order under international law among states.
Now, Cliff, I know from the looking at the research you've done over the many years that when you look at this development in the 20s and 30s and early 40s in Europe, the way it's usually taught is you had these strong men, these charismatic figures. But actually, that's only part of the story. You discovered documents from the 1940s from U.S. intelligence, which actually fills out the picture in a different way. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, when you look at the picture, Mussolini just doesn't walk into office on his own, nor does Mr. Hitler or any of these dictators. They are put there by powerful economic, we could call them lobbies. We're not going to use the word conspiracy here. We could say lobbies and interest groups, powerful economic lobbies and interest groups, banking interests, heavy industry interests, placed these dictators into power, gave them money for their campaigns and got them into power. And that's what we opposed then in World War II. But people don't realize that within our own country, here in the United States, certain, obviously not all, but certain very powerful American business interests, lobbies we could call them, such as the House of Morgan Banking Group, persons connected to General Motors, persons connected to the DuPont interests, back in the and Time Magazine, the Hearst Press, back in the 1920s and 1930s, actually, it's hard to believe now, but they took a shine to fascism. And it's easy to document. In one sense, you can go down to any public library that has old issues of Time Magazine and just pick up the first year, 1923, pick up the first year of Time Magazine and take a look at that cover they did on Mussolini and portraying Mussolini as a great guy. So essentially what we've seen in our own country is the development since the 1920s of a circle of financial and business interests that thought that fascism is a pretty good idea for the United States.
And in your presentation in Berlin, you actually identified this group as behind a coup attempt against President Roosevelt.
Well, yes. There was a group, and you can Google it on the Internet if you want or look it up any way you wish, but there was a group called the American Liberty League, Liberty League for short, and it was composed of a bunch of Wall Street big shots, the Morgan interests, the DuPont interests, as I mentioned, and others, a bunch of Wall Street big shots that didn't like the New Deal. They didn't like Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. They didn't like Franklin Roosevelt. So after he got elected in 32, they immediately started figuring out ways of more than just cramping his style, actually possibly even launching a coup d'etat, an armed coup d'etat in the United States. And so I went through the history of this American, so-called American Liberty League. And one of the key things that I wanted to point out is that American Liberty League, those American businessmen, where did they get their ideas from? Well, they got their ideas from Europe, from the European fascists. That's where they got their ideas. And they, how did they do that? Well, they were in business with them. Don't forget, the Wall Street boys were international businessmen, international bankers in particular, international heavy industry. So that these Wall Street boys came into contact with their counterparts in Europe. Just for example, like our current President George Bush's family. Now, it may seem pretty amazing to listeners, but the historical fact is that George Bush's family, the Walkers and others, were directly involved with the people that put Hitler into power in Germany. That is the Tyson interests and other of these big business interests in Germany. So what we're looking at prior to World War II is the organized efforts of some big bankers in Wall Street, big industrialists in the United States, like the DuPont boys and others, who wanted to alter our form of government and really have a dictatorial regime, let's say. And that was their angle. Now, we fought World War II to oppose that in Italy, in Japan, in Germany. But, boy, right after World War II stops, these boys are back at it again under the Truman administration. I'm sure we can talk about that, too.
Yes, Jeffrey Steinberg has just written an article that will be the lead of next week's Executive Intelligence Review, identifying that at the moment FDR took his last breath, Truman was inserted to precisely to defend not just the synarchist networks and let them out of jail, but to overturn FDR's policies. Now, I just before we get to some other questions on this, I'd like to just take it up to the present. The development of the particularly the neoconservative movement in the going back to 2000, the 2001 emergence of Bush-Cheney, the idea of globalization today, global free markets, the destruction of the nation state. You see a direct parallel in what you saw with the synarchist moves to take over the countries of Europe and also try to take over the United States.
Yes, indeed. I think it not only reflects a similar or the same type of thinking, but also actually, if you look at it, similar types of personalities in international business and in international banking. The neoconservatives are simply a intellectual stable of operatives that these higher circles, the international banking circles and business circles, have selected to implement policy. The big boys like to stay behind the scenes, and they need some intellectuals to implement policies, and that's where the neocons come in.
Now, the neocons are not exactly the garden variety Republican that you remember from growing up the 60s, are they?
Absolutely. The Republican Party today, and I have to say I'm a Republican, the Republican Party today has got nothing to do with the Republican Party Abraham Lincoln started. Nothing to do with the Republican Party down through the early 1900s here and the progressive movement under Bob La Follette and that type of progressive Republican. The current Republican Party has really been taken over, if you want to be frank about it, has been taken over by people that have a what we could call a classic fascist mentality. Mr. Cheney is representative of that. Mr. Schultz is representative of that. The neocon gophers, policy gophers, they're representative of this sort of, we can call it a fascist mentality. Now, what they seek to do is to create, they think, an American empire, a unilateral, unipolar world in which the Americans are like a new Rome or a new British Empire. Pat Buchanan wrote a book, Empire or Republic, and of course, I'm sure we all would prefer to be a republic rather than an empire. But this is their goal. Their goal is, it's obviously a delusional goal. It's obviously a fantasy. But it's a very dangerous one, as we can see the Middle East blowing up in the last couple of days through our encouragement represents.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Dr. Clifford Kirikoff, who was a participant in the EIR seminar in Berlin last month. We do have a white paper that's been produced with speeches from that conference, including Cliff Kirikoff's speech. It's available through LaRouche PAC, and those listeners who'd like to get copies of it, it's called LaRouche in Berlin Exposes Synarchist Enemies of the United States. And it has some opening comments from Lyndon LaRouche. It includes this presentation we've been discussing on the show today with Cliff Kirikoff. Also, Jeffrey Steinberg on how we can beat the democratic fascists around Felix Roetten. Helge Zepp LaRouche's comments on the synarchist takeover in Berlin. And a very interesting paper from Jacques Cheminade, who's running for president of France, Let's Stop Putting France on Sale, where he identifies this historic tradition in France. Now, this pamphlet, or this white paper, I should say, is already out in circulation. I'd like to bring in Brian from Washington, D.C. Brian, are we getting this out in Washington and getting it to the Congress?
Yeah, sure. We have received, since I think last Tuesday, some large shipments of the white paper, which we've been saturating the streets and saturating the Congress with. It's had a very good effect in the field, and we're getting a lot of good responses from the population. And obviously, the Congress, this is something that they need to understand, and people like Rohatyn to really understand what he represents and really break with that. So, yeah, getting out all over the city.
And so we're just now. You say we're getting them to the Congress. Did we distribute them in the congressional office buildings?
Yeah, sure. Well, this the contents have come out in the EIR as well. So we've been getting the contents of the material in there, but the white paper, yeah, with this last week, we've hand-delivered that to every single congressional office and every single Senate office, and really engaged in a lot of debate with the staffers, and when we can grab the congressmen as well to really challenge them on this question of what Rohatyn represents as this fascist tradition, as Mr. Kirikov has laid out in his article and here on the show, and that they have to understand. You know, in the discussion with one congressional staffer, we had a good discussion when I was bringing up the question of Rohatyn and the synarchy. He responded, well, you're talking about Prescott Bush and the Brown Brothers Harriman Bank, because he had obviously been reading our material and doing some of his own research on this. So, working to educate the Congress. And in discussion with this guy, I brought up to him, I said, well, you seem to understand this somewhat, but what do you think the congressmen and the rest of the Congress understands about these things? And he said, well, that's part of the problem with the Congress, is that their memory goes back about 3 years, and then it cuts off. So we're talking about 50 or 60 or 70 years worth of history, and they tend to focus very narrowly on their campaigns and kind of the current popular opinion issues, and not really grounded in the history the way that Lynn is and the way they need to be. So
I would agree with you on that, but I would say Lynn has been saying in the last couple of days, it goes a little further, they don't want to fight. They know that if you bring up the kinds of questions that Dr. Kirikov has presented so far, that you're identifying yourself as opposing the globalization policies and going up against Rohatyn. And I think there's a lot of fear of that. And the Democrats really need to have their feet held to the fire if they're going to get off the schneid and do something on this. Now, Brian, we have a webcast coming up this Thursday. Lyndon LaRouche will be speaking in Washington, D.C. It will be available on LaRouchePAC.com on Thursday, the 20th. At 1 p.m. Eastern Time. How's the organizing going for that?
Good. We've pulled together organized a lot of students to come in for the meeting, but also obviously these congressional staffers and the congressmen to tune in and also attend the webcast personally. So that's
definitely. I understand we have somewhere in the range of 40 people from unions and state legislators from around the country expected.
Sure. Yeah, and there's been a big controversy because they know, or on the Hill, because they know when we come there with the union leaders and also the state reps that we shake things up. So there's some congressional offices which are, as you said, very freaked out about the types of responsibility that we want to hold these guys to, and of course we are holding their feet to the fire, so they're a little freaked out about us coming back and a little scared because they know the kind of pressure we're going to put on them. But
okay,
yeah.
We're going to take a short break, and I'm going to talk to our listeners now about what they can do to hold the congressman's feet to the fire. First and foremost, call in and get copies of this white paper, and also the white paper Time is Running Out on the USA, which was put together to go through the details of Rohatyn and Lazard Frere, their policies of destroying the industrial economy of the United States, and the importance of the legislation proposed by Lyndon LaRouche to reverse that. So you can get these white papers and get the EIR by calling toll-free number 888-347-3258. That's 888-347-3258, and tell them you heard it on the LaRouche Show and you want to get the literature so you can go out and save this country. Join the LaRouche Youth Movement, Lyndon LaRouche, and the patriots of both parties. As we just heard from Dr. Kirikov, it's not just Democrats but Republicans who have to stand up and defend the nation. So the white paper is available, and then this coming Thursday, July 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche will give another in his series of webcasts, where he'll put a very clear picture forward on what's facing us, what we have to do to get out of this crisis, and why the Americans cannot wait any longer to get into this fight. So we're back with our guest, Dr. Clifford Kirikoff. We heard from Brian McAndrew. We'll hear in a moment from Jason. But, Cliff, I know that as someone who spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill, what effect does it have if people start hearing from the constituents on matters that they usually don't hear from? Usually they hear about a Social Security check or a VA problem. What effect does it have in a congressional office if people are calling in saying, we want you to do something about fascism?
Oh, I think it has a tremendous effect. Folks may not know that offices, whether they're a congressional office or a senatorial office, are very concerned about the mail or the telephone calls they get from their own constituents. So if you live in a particular congressional district and you wish to express yourself, express your points to that congressman. If you live in any particular state, then you express your opinions to the senator of your state. That's the way to get attention. And, of course, in the offices themselves, frankly, the better offices will take a tabulation of letters and mail coming in and a tabulation of phone calls coming in and the issues and brief their member once a week on it or more often. So handwritten letters are much more effective than form letters. If you feel strongly about something, just get out a postcard or get out a letter paper, write a handwritten letter to your congressman or senator. That way they know it's not some mass mailing of some kind. And as those things start to mount up every week, those members of Congress and senators look at those statistics and they start to realize that these issues are starting to really affect the way folks back home, that is to say the voters that vote for them, think.
From your experience, what percentage of the members of the Senate, for example, actually do have the capacity to discuss these more in-depth historical issues?
Well, I was there in the for the decade of the 1980s and early 90s. I would say out of 100 senators, you had a handful that could engage in some fairly serious discussion. Today, I'd be hard-pressed. You're probably less than a handful today that are...
As Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing, the House is taken over predominantly by boomers and tweeners, and you still have a few old war horses in the Senate, but we are seeing the effects of the destruction, the deliberate destruction of this history, so that people have no conception of where these things come from.
Well, yes, and of course when the purpose, well, one of the purposes, of course, of Congress is to create legislation, to create laws, to manage our lives here under the Constitution, and another task of Congress is oversight, to oversee the activities of the executive branch and government in general. And as the quality and tone of the debate disintegrates, the ability of members of the House or Senate to create quality legislation or to engage in conscientious and serious oversight is very rapidly degraded. And what does that do? Well, that opens the door for the imperial presidency. It opens the door for a fascist in the White House. He can get away with whatever he wants because he knows Congress isn't going to be holding him accountable.
It's a compelling picture. Let me bring in Jason Ross, who actually did some work with you a couple of years ago, I think, on some of the research you were doing out here in California. Jason, what are we doing in California, as far as you know, with these new white papers?
Well, sometimes it's a bit of a shock that things like the Nazis in the Democratic Party or Felix Rosen and the Nazis work, because sometimes there's an internal idea that, well, that's a rather extreme thing to say. People don't already know that. Can we organize with it? We can, because the documentation that's been pulled together in these white papers is, I mean, it's cut and dry. It's completely compelling that we do have a fascist takeover inside the government. We've seen the part of what Brian was referring to in the Congress of a freak out around going all the way around this discussion of fascism. We've been seeing that here as well with some of the work that we've been doing in the state capitol here in Sacramento, where meetings we were formerly able to have easy enough about federal, you know, political issues, the economy, things that sometimes maybe people were able to be a little bit more comfortably distant from, they're not anymore around this question of fascism. And we've seen like a very intense kind of shock in Sacramento of people canceling meetings, freaking out around this idea. But it's exactly the right thing to do. Like, it's something that causes that much kind of difficulty among people. It means you've hit something that's really good inside the political layers. And inside the population, it's wonderful because it helps to kind of make clear to people's minds why the Democrats have been such cowards. Beyond the fact that many of them don't want to fight, you've got a very clear example of an out-and-out Nazi who is taking over the party, which helps to clarify the impotence and also give like a specific way of how you can root it out.
Now, Jason, you told me you had a question for Dr. Kirikoff on the question of France.
Well, this is—I don't know if this is the biggest, most relevant thing right now, but among the nations you were mentioning at first, you know, Romania, Italy, Germany, Spain, and then what you had with the white paper going through about the French allowing the Nazis to take them over incredibly rapidly. I was kind of wondering why the French fascists weren't able to pull it off earlier. Like, what in France actually prevented a more direct takeover of fascism in that country if they had to wait for Hitler to do it?
Well, the French did have a fairly strong labor movement, and I think you would find that the labor movement itself in the 1930s and others was a restraining factor for the interests in France who wish to impose a more fascist regime. Also, elements of the Roman Catholic Church that opposed fascistic-type philosophy were also a factor. So I think in France they had some internal, you could say, defense mechanisms. Also, of course, the French traditionally take a dim view, I guess you'd say, of the Germans and all. So I think that there were elements within France that were able to resist, an overt, rapid fascist dictatorship. But that's not to say that the fascists in France didn't try several times to have coup d'états in France. They failed, but they did try. Pardon?
Yeah. Around Pierre Laval.
Well, and Pierre Laval, of course, was an old German agent, Nazi agent from way back, and so he was one of the worst of the bunch over there, collaborator, you could say, or Nazi lover. But this all relates to the bigger picture of the synarchy, of course. That is to say, that organized network of powerful business interests, powerful banking and industrial interests, who thought they could just sort of, well, take over all of Europe. And they would use Hitler and Mussolini as their boys to kind of bring Europe into line behind them, and so that they could have make a lot of money, a lot of profits on steel and coal and heavy industry and finance, and also have the fascists keep the masses in line, so to speak, so that the plutocracy could live off the fat of the land.
That actually brings us to the question of the role of Lazard Frères and Banque Worms, the two of the leading financial institutions in France that supported synarchy.
Sure. You have, now obviously, in any country, in any business community, you have very decent businessmen and decent banking interests and others. But you also have not-so-decent interests. And in the particular case of France, with the Lazard Frères and with Banque Worms and some of these other major banking operations, the Rothschilds and others, you had some pretty nefarious activities going on, because these were the very people who were financing fascist politicians. These were the very people who were trying to consolidate the economy, we could call it concentrate industry, eliminate the middle class, eliminate those small and medium-sized businesses, and have their country run by a combination of the really giant business corporations and the banks.
And for those who don't know or have forgotten, Felix Rowetten, who we've been talking about as the leading opposition to Lyndon LaRouche's auto legislation, as well as someone who's directly involved in destroying the auto industry, as well as the steel industry and whatever else he can get his hands on, Felix Rowetten comes out of the Lazard Frères banking network as a protege of André Maillard.
Yes, he's typical of these very, very high-level European businessmen. He's an American nowadays, but he came over from Europe after World War II. He's typical of these very, very high-powered European businessmen who are committed to what we would call today globalization, committed to the breakdown of the nation-state and the replacement of the nation-state, or just the breaking it down, replacement with a political order dominated by, first and foremost, the big banks, and secondarily by heavy industry, because the real point of the big financial interests is they always want big industry to kind of be under their thumb. So they want to be the top dog, so to speak.
Well, and Cliff, let me just ask you this, because I think it's important to make this totally clear for people. One of the objections they have to the nation state is, as we saw again under Franklin Roosevelt, in rejecting the period of deregulation in the 20s, the nation state, by asserting the right to defend the general welfare, regulates these interests, puts a block to the cartelization, so to speak, of banking, insurance, steel, auto, and so on. Do you see that as a common effect that cartels in the 30s with the globalization of today and free trade and deregulation?
Well, absolutely. The reason they don't want a nation state is because they don't want constitutional republics or constitutional governments. In a constitutional republic like ours, Congress has an oversight capacity as well as a regulatory and legislative capacity. Well, for the big boys, you have to basically nullify the power of Congress to legislate, to regulate, to oversee, and protect the general welfare. And so, therefore, this idea of globalization is essentially like taking a giant eraser and erasing all the various state boundaries in the world and just having the whole planet under the domination of the international bankers.
Okay, you're listening to Dr. Clifford Karakoff on the LaRouche Show today, July 15th, 2006. I'm going to go to an email question, and then we'll go back to our LaRouche Youth Movement panelists. This is from Spencer Cross from Seattle. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this book, Cliff, but he asks about Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here.
Well, sure. Sinclair Lewis was a very famous American writer, and he was very, very good on his research, as any novelist would be. And I was just reading the other day a book by George Seldes, another famous American journalist of the era. And in the Seldes book, he says how Sinclair Lewis would talk to him about when Seldes was reporting from Italy and reporting from fascist Europe. And he kept asking Seldes questions, and he asked other people questions about, well, what was it like in Italy under Mussolini? What was it like in the fascist Europe? And then what Sinclair Lewis did is he took those points that he learned from experts about European fascism, and he wove that into his very, very famous American novel. I have to say, I'm sure it was one of the, Sinclair Lewis is one of the great American writers of the 20th century. So it's a book, actually. It's well worth a read.
Absolutely, and I would recommend it to people. It's called It Can't Happen Here, and it shows how under the cover of religious fundamentalism, a movement started to bring fascism to the United States. What I find interesting is when you pair that with Elmer Gantry, which was his expose of the phony fundamentalist movements
right.
that were emerging in the 1920s, you actually get an indication or an inkling of his understanding of the weakness in the culture of the United States that could be used to create a fascist movement.
Well, I agree with you entirely, Harley. I can say from my own personal experience in the Senate of the United States in the 1980s, I personally witnessed the rise of this radical so-called Christian, which of course it isn't, fundamentalist right. And you could see right then the early indicators of the threat to our constitutional form of government posed by this theocratic element. And of course the famous political analyst Kevin Phillips has written a recent book everyone should read called American Theocracy. I guess the readers could read Sinclair Lewis for the novel form and could read Kevin Phillips' book to just get the reality.
Exactly. And then, of course, you can call us at EIR and get the updated
get the real reality
reports. Yeah. Brian, do you have another question for Cliff or something else you'd like to add?
Yeah, well, this is a question I got from a congressional staffer. They were doing some research on the Prescott Bush, Brown Brothers Harriman connection, and how he explained how FDR seized the assets of Brown Brothers Harriman in 45. And apparently at that time, Prescott Bush had, I think, one share in the bank, which he had bought for $145. And then in 52, the assets were, I guess, released or given back, and it was worth like over $1 million or something. So he wanted to know about how the finance worked, I guess, from when FDR seized it and put a clamp down and went after these guys to after his death, and I guess under Truman, how the assets were returned and these guys just went back to work.
Well, there's 2 points there. One, I think it was a number of different banking interests, and I think there was a joint bank called Union something or other bank.
Union Bank Corporation in New York, which was Prescott Bush and Roland Harriman were the two.
And the Tyson, the financier of Hitler.
Yeah.
Tyson wrote a book, I Paid Hitler. I mean, you can read the book. So at any rate, what I would recommend for the staffer would be to task the Library of Congress Research Service to do a study on how Roosevelt administration handled what we would call enemy property, how they handled enemy assets in the United States. Being a mostly foreign-owned bank by German interests, it would qualify certainly to be enemy property. And so I would say that your staff person could ask the congressional research folks to work up a document showing how the administration of FDR handled enemy property in the United States and businesses that were operated by Nazi or Italian fascists or other interests against whom we were, of course, fighting World War II.
Yeah, the Union Bank Corporation actually was seized by the Attorney General of the United States in October 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act.
Yes, we did that. The Trading with the Enemy Act came about in 1917, and that was responsive to the situation we found ourselves at that time when we were entering into World War I, and we had the problem of enemy property in the United States, that is to say, German-owned corporations, et cetera, in the United States. So that Trading with the Enemy Act was created in 1917, actually based on a 1916 legislation in England.
And it would be useful for people to know that the grandfather of the President of the United States was one of the funders of Adolf Hitler.
Well, I think it's fairly frightening, and I think it's not atypical of a lot of people in the administration.
And that's precisely the question that you took up in your presentation and that Lyndon LaRouche has repeatedly taken up, that this, unless you understand the history of the United States as a republic, and that there's been a consistent effort from European oligarchical interests to destroy that, you cannot understand how we ended up in the mess we're in today.
Well, they tried to destroy our revolution. Remember when the Rothschilds financed the Hessian troops to come over here? So the international bankers back in the 1776 period and all, when we were fighting our own American Revolution, those international bankers were financing military troops that were used by the British to attempt to defeat us.
Now, I want to go to a second email we got, Cliff, and see if you have some thoughts on this. It's from Eugene, doesn't say where he's from, but he asks about the significance of the Mexican presidential election and the probable outcome, the fact that López Obrador is claiming that he won the election, and he has a number of indications that widespread fraud was committed against him, and the PAN, which actually started as the Sinarchist Party in Mexico, is represented by Calderón, who's saying we're not going to count the votes. You have any thoughts on that, Cliff?
Well, I think the relationship between the United States and Mexico is an extremely important one, and we should follow events down there very carefully. My hunch would be that Mr. Obrador probably did win the election. But the powers that be down there are, let's say, not the most honest folks in the world, and they can fiddle around with the results and basically generate the results they want. Nonetheless, we need to take a stance toward Mexico as a potentially friendly country. Mr. Juarez, years back, supported Lincoln in holding our republic together. So we do have good common bases for being friends. But it's a very difficult relationship, and I think we need to keep our eye on it because, of course, any kind of instability in Mexico, financial in particular, has obviously a very a direct relationship on our own economy and security.
Well, unlike Al Gore, who basically did everything possible to make sure that there was no effective counter to the fraud in Florida in 2000, López Obrador is mobilizing the people. There's a plan for a very large demonstration this weekend in Mexico City. And the Mexican LaRouche youth movement are right at the center of that, circulating Lyndon LaRouche's statement. But I agree, keep an eye on it. It's an extremely important matter. The destruction by free trade and globalization of the Mexican economy is the main impetus that's led to the widespread flow of people from Mexico.
Oh, it's a real tragedy. There's villages in the center and south of Mexico that are kind of devoid of the, older generation, working men, et cetera, et cetera. It's really harmed the Mexican economy terribly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Jason, do you have another question or comment for Dr. Kirikoff?
Yeah, I was wondering more about the about this this business plot, this attempted coup against Franklin Roosevelt. One thing I was wondering was, because this seems to, I had never, outside of around the LaRouche movement, I had never heard about this. I was wondering how, if that was completely common knowledge at the time, and then.
Yes, it was completely common knowledge at the time because the Congress of the United States, the House of Representatives, had a committee, McCormick-Dickstein committee, that was set up in 1934 to actually investigate the coup attempt. And the congressional committee prepared a report that indicated that, yes, indeed, they investigated reports about the coup attempt, and they found that the reports were authentic, that indeed Wall Street types had tried to get a patriotic general, General Smedley Butler, to sort of lead a coup against President Roosevelt. But General Butler, who was a friend of President Roosevelt's, quickly informed President Roosevelt about the plot, and then General Butler went public in the press, Philadelphia and elsewhere, and then Congress investigated. Now, if you take a look at even standard histories of the New Deal, say by such famous professors as Professor Schlesinger, you'll see a little notice once in a while about the Liberty League in there. Leuchtenberg's book on FDR, you'll also see a little notice about the Liberty League and their plots. But normally they haven't gone into great detail. There's only one book I know, I own it, written by an academic about the Liberty League, and there were a couple of scholarly articles in the 1950s, and that's about it.
Wow.
Okay. Well, as in the case of many areas of U.S. history, a lot of it has disappeared. Cliff, let me just come back to the situation we're facing today with the war in the Middle East and the dangers there.
Sure.
Lyndon LaRouche has identified, and the EIR has reported on this, that Dick Cheney 3 weeks ago had a meeting under the auspices of the American Enterprise Institute in Colorado with Bibi Netanyahu. And at this point, there was likely a signal given to Israel, given that the attempt to get a war with Iran was being thwarted by networks within the intelligence community and the military, that this would be the way to get the war going would be to unleash Israel. What can you tell us about such ideas as the breakaway ally scenario, the use of Israel
sure.
as a surrogate? And
sure. You raise a very good point. And let's take a look at the big picture. We already have 135,000 men and women under arms in Iraq. There's only one way we can extract them in a orderly way, and that's through a regional understanding. We have to go to the neighbors of Iraq, Syria, Iran, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. We have to go to those neighbors of Iraq and say, now look, we're going to extract our 135,000 men and women from Iraq. Don't cause us any problems. We'll move out. We can all work together to the reconstruction of Iraq in the future. And on top of that, you got another level of diplomacy. You got to work with Russia, with China, with Europe, with the UN in order to get this regional solution, this regional development going. Now, what happens when Israel goes off and does what it just did? That just shatters the entire stability of the region. Now, I think we need to be honest with ourselves. Neither Israel nor any other state in the region can have any long-term security without stability. So if Israel engages in destabilizing the region, Israel is cutting its own throat in the long run, not to mention the throats of everybody else, including us in the United States. So the short answer to your question is that this destabilization of the region unleashed by Israel is very dangerous. It could escalate, or let's pray that it does not, but it could escalate, and it certainly undermines the American ability to organize through diplomacy a regional understanding that would allow us to extricate in an orderly manner our 135,000 troops that are basically right now sitting ducks out there.
Now, it's also my understanding that there were very important people, besides the retired generals, the generals' revolt that came out calling for Rumsfeld's head, that even within the active duty military, there was strong opposition to going to war with Iran, and also a lot of sympathy for the motions of John Murtha in the House and John Kerry in the Senate. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's quite true. But as you know, under our system, all active duty military are in a chain of command. Our commander-in-chief, the President of the United States, is at the top of that chain of command. So active duty officers or enlisted men who are in that chain of command, they have to keep their criticisms to themselves and within their services. It's not appropriate for them to come out publicly outside the chain of command. But what you look for is, what are the retired folks saying? What are the retired generals and admirals saying? That's when you can kind of figure out what the people inside are really thinking. And I think if you focus on someone like General Zini, for example, former head of CENTCOM, and other generals and admirals at his level who have spoken out publicly, I dare say, because I work with active duty military, I dare say that that reflects the vast majority of America's active duty officer corps.
Well, then that also then puts back on the citizen who's not in the military, but the actual citizen of the United States, a responsibility to move the Congress, especially if the executive branch, under its theory of the unitary executive, is saying they're going to ignore the Congress and the courts and do what they want. We saw the Supreme Court coming back, putting a bit of a chink in the Bush plan on Guantanamo and rendition and so on. But it really does mean that the citizen has to be engaged. And isn't that, after all, what a republic is about?
Well, absolutely. And that old story, and I think it's a true one, about when Benjamin Franklin was asked after the convention, well, sir, what did you give us? And he said, well, we gave you a republic, if you can keep it. And keeping it means citizens behaving like citizens, taking an interest in their local, their state, their national politics, and doing what they can as an individual person, as an individual citizen, to be a good and patriotic citizen, which means step forth, let your voice be counted, write a letter to the editor of your newspaper, contact your congressman and senator. Don't be passive, don't sit back, because, heck, that's the way good old Mussolini and Hitler and those people were so easily able to clamber into power.
We're coming toward the end of the show. Brian, do you have any estimate on how many of these pamphlets, these white papers, were getting out in D.C.?
I'd say so far at least a couple thousand, and then we're going to have roughly about 100 youth in the city all of next week for our week of action. And we have a good 10 or 20,000 here ready to go to hit the streets starting Monday. So we are definitely going to saturate this city. Everyone's going to know Rohatyn's name and this fascist clique within the United States, which we have to defeat.
Well, anyone who wants to get a copy, if you're not in D.C. or in a place where you can run into the LaRouche Youth Movement easily, give us a call at 888-347-3258 and ask for a copy of the white paper on the Berlin conference. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, by all means, make it to the webcast on Thursday, the 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're not in D.C., you can pick it up on the LaRouchePact.com website. Cliff, it's been a great pleasure to have you with us today, and you know, we should do this again.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Harley, and it's great to be with Jason and Brian as well.
Okay, and Brian and Jason, thank you. I just emphasize that as we started the show, we're headed toward a situation where we could have war, depression, chaos, and fascism, or we could have an FDR impulse. Lyndon LaRouche at this point is the center of the FDR impulse with the LaRouche Youth Movement. You got to join us now. Time is running out on the U.S. Thank you very much, and that's the LaRouche Show for today.